Well, hey everyone, we're glad you're here. My name's Justin Buzzard. I'm losing my voice. I'm pretty sick, so I'm gonna do the best I can to talk. I don't normally sound this way. We're glad you're here. Stephen and I wrote this book in hopes that it would really help people better understand this moment that we're in, understanding what God is doing in the cities of our world today, and help people get a bigger vision for what God might want to do in our cities. It's fun co-writing this book because Stephen and I were good friends. We met at the very first Gospel Coalition Conference, which was that 6 years ago? What was that, the very first one? It wasn't really advertised. It was just a couple hundred people. We met and immediately hit it off. My wife is from Boston, where Stephen is, and so we go out there as a family each summer. And when we're there in Boston during the summer, I spend time at Stephen's church, and we spend time connecting. So a friendship really grew, and it's great. We have a very similar, the same gospel, similar theology and vision and heart for the city, yet we're very different people. I'm in my early 30s, he's in his early 40s. I'm obviously writing and coming at this as a white guy, grew up in the majority culture here in America. Stephen's coming at this as an Asian American who grew up in the minority culture. I have three sons, he has three daughters. Stephen dresses in suits and I dress like this, so very different. And we're tied here, they're recording this, so I'm tied to this thing. I normally speak and move all over, so that's why we're standing behind this deal, because they have to record this. Okay, I'm trying to speak as loud as I can. I'm sorry, but this voice is going. So you can come up to the front if you can't hear me. So there's seats in the front. You move to the very front. You're likely to hear a little bit more. What we're not saying in this book is we're not saying that cities are more important than other places, than other contexts. What we are saying is that cities are very important and strategic places for doing gospel ministry, and we want to understand them. If you think about how many gospel preaching churches you would need to reach a small town of, say, 10,000, you'd need maybe four gospel preaching churches there to really start to reach that small town. But if you have a small city of, say, 100,000, you need, maybe 40 gospel preaching churches there to begin to really saturate that city and impact it with the gospel. But if you've got a big city, a city of 1 million, you're talking about 400 gospel preaching churches you need to see there. And so we want people to see how, as we plant churches, as we proclaim the gospel in the great cities of our world, something really significant can begin to happen. Where we're headed in the next hour is Stephen is going to come up, and he's going to give us an overview of cities, the characteristics of cities, what the Bible has to say about why cities are important and why they matter. Then I will come back up if I still have a voice and talk about contextualizing in the city, how you do life and ministry and present the gospel. And then we're going to do some Q&A at the end. Before that, two quick book giveaways. So we're going to do trivia, and if you get the question right and I see your hand first, you're going to get a copy of the book, Why City. Who already has a copy of the book, Why Cities Matter? Okay. The rest of you need to change that and go get a book at the end. It's for sale in the bookstore. It's on sale there. You can get a good deal there. You can also still right now go on Amazon and get it for 48% off. So it's an incredible deal. So you could order that on Amazon for a great deal. So first question, what is the biggest city in America? Raised hand. Right there. All right. Easy. You got it. First one. Okay. This next one's a little tougher. What is the second most dense city in America? Nope. Good try.
Billy.
Nope.
Samuel.
Nope.
Dallas.
Nope.
Miami.
Nope.
Houston.
Nope.
San Antonio.
Nope. Nope.
Columbus.
Nope. Sorry.
Austin.
Man, you guys really need to be at this seminar. Nope.
Detroit.
Nope. Second most densely populated city. It's not the second biggest city, second most densely populated city.
New York.
No. Nope. Okay. I'm just going to.
San Francisco.
Yeah, you get it. San Francisco. Okay. San Francisco. Okay. Dr. Stephen Am is going to come take the stage.
I actually didn't know that. so thank you for sharing that, Justin. As Justin said, this book is not about why cities matter more. We gave complimentary copy to all the council members, and they were very grateful, many of them who are not urban pastors. thanking us that there was a very collegial tone to what we were trying to say. I mean, that'd be pretty arrogant, right, if someone were to say that. We say that we need churches wherever there are people. And there are people in rural places and suburban places and in the countryside and in cities. But the point that we're trying to make is that cities are strategic places to be. And since there aren't many churches in cities and many people have moved away from cities, we're trying to come alongside some people and to say that perhaps God could be calling you into cities to plant churches. And of course, in cities, you've got all different diversity of different ways that you can do ministry, and it's not just one type of ministry. When you think about urban ministry, I think about 30 years ago, people were thinking primarily about inner city ministry, and that's one very important type of ministry and a church plant that you might have. But you can be at a community, what we will call an edge ex-urban community, which is still very, very urban, but right at the outside because people have gone out there because of affordable housing issues. Or you can also have planted a center city church. Now, nearly 5.5 million people move into cities every month. That is a new San Francisco being created every month. 22% of the world's population lives in 600 cities, and 600 cities represent 60% of the world's economic output. Or you can say that 40 mega regions, right? When we say mega regions, we're not talking about a particular metropolitan area. We're talking about mega regions. Urbanists talk about different ones. And so in my region, the mega region would be one of the top 40 in the world, would be Boston, New York, Philly, DC. That's one big mega region. And 40 of those mega regions in the world account for two-thirds of the world's economic output. So the economic output of the city of New York is larger than that of the nation of Sweden. So you clearly know that we no longer live in a nation-state island of governance, but now we live in a city-state, which is very comparable to what we found in the early church. Also, China's urban population in the next 20 years will increase 350 million people. In 20 years, you've got another size of the United States. That's China's urban population. In the year 1800, you had around 2% of the world's population living in urban centers. In the year 1900, people debate anywhere from 12 to 14%. In the year 2000, you had right around 50%. And now in the year 2013, about 52% of the world's population lives in centers. In cities. So by 2050, the world will be almost 70% urban. So again, we're not saying therefore, oh, the suburban places or rural places are unimportant. That's not our point. We're saying this is the trajectory of our world. And the question is, we as Christians and as churches, are we going to respond to it? Because we will need many churches in cities because that's where all the people are going. Al Mohler has given us this challenge when he says, this much is clear, the cities are where the people are. In the course of less than 300 years, our world will have shifted from one in which only 3% of people live in cities to one in which 80% are resident in urban areas. If the Christian church does not learn new modes of urban ministry, we will find ourselves on the outside looking in. The gospel of Jesus Christ must call a new generation of committed Christians into these teeming cities. As these new numbers make clear, there really is no choice. That's from Al Mohler. Now, when you look at the history of the development of cities have always been influential, and there have been four great waves of urbanization. The first wave has been the imperial city, the ancient cities such as Babylon, Alexandria, Rome. And the second wave, commercial cities. You have Paris, Venice, and Milan, and the like. And then the third wave of industrial cities such as London and Detroit and St. Petersburg. And the fourth and the greatest wave, and we're in that moment right now, is what Saskia Sassen from Columbia calls global cities, or what many urbanists call mega cities, or mega cities or megalopolises, not metropolitan areas anymore, because we're talking about mega regions. Now, there are three ingredients to what makes a city a city. Cities are centers of power, culture, and worship. So the first is cities are centers of power. Cities were originally centers of safety, refuge, and shelter. In the ancient world, they did not categorize a city as a city because of its population. But it talked about describing a city in the ancient world because of two things. Number one, because of its density, and secondly, because it was fortified. So in the ancient world, to actually have like 3,000 or 4,000 residents in a city was very, very common. So when you look at the city of Nineveh with hundreds of thousands, that was a pretty massive city in the ancient world. So again, cities were originally centers of safety, refuge, and shelter. And power is now concentrated around wealth and governance. You see governance in D.C., economics in New York and Tokyo, and so on. So Florida, Richard Florida, who is a pretty well-known urbanist, and not everyone agrees with his conclusions about the rise of the creative class and so on. For example, Joel Kotkin, who's a well-known urbanist, you know, they kind of, there's this intramural battle between these urbanists. But Florida says, in the United States, more than 90% of all economic output is produced in metropolitan regions, while just the largest five metro regions account for 25% of all of the output. So again, we're not saying that the Christian mission should be defined by the power structures of our day. We're just trying to give you a brief survey of the sociological phenomena of our world through globalization. And we need to be aware of these power structures as centers of power that provide safety, governance, and economic opportunity. So then the question is, will gospel churches and Christians be present when the world arrives in the city? Because it's happened, and it's going to continue to happen. And the question is, are we going to be there to participate in this movement? Secondly, cities are centers of culture. The majority of influential cultural products and artifacts are produced in cities, and I'm not going to go through the list. But if we want to see live theater and our favorite sports teams, the greatest symphonies and museums, world-class cities, they're going to be found in cities. Now, some of you might be saying, hey, I live in a kind of a suburban area near a city. We've got some of those things as well. But and you might say, hey, Joel Kotkin has said and written an article recently for Fortune magazine where he is saying that he sees many 20-somethings actually leaving the city to live in these suburban places. And so how are you going to refute that? Well, I really don't need to. He's actually making our point. And that is, again, because of affordable housing, people can't afford to live in the center, a part of a city, because it's very, very expensive. So they're living 10, 12 miles away in these, what we will call edge, ex-urban communities, or what Doug Saunders has called an arrival city, but they still work and play in the city. So in other words, the influence of the city is affecting those people who live out in the suburbs. It's not as though they're leaving the city because they don't want to have anything to do with the city. It's really because of affordable housing issues. We do want to say that that we want to move beyond this false dichotomy of city versus suburbs. There's an interplay. This is not just city propaganda, and that we've got a fight that we want to pick with those people who are in suburban places. But here's the thing. No one needs to write a book on why the suburbs matter. You see? Because that's where a lot of the churches are, and that's great. They need to be there. Again, we need to have gospel-preaching churches, gospel-shaped churches, gospel-believing churches, wherever there are people. And there are people in the suburbs, and there are people in rural places, and there are people in the countryside. But there are less people there than there are people in cities. And therefore, we as Christians need to have a burden, just as Paul had a burden. That was really the design in the book of Acts. That's undeniable, by the way. So we need to respond to this. And lastly, cities are centers of worship. The historian Lewis Mumford says that the first germ of the city is in the ceremonial meeting place because it concentrates certain spiritual or supernatural powers. Now, it's not a question of whether cities are centers of worship. You might have been somewhat surprised by that category. Cities have always been built around the things that their inhabitants see as holding cosmic significance. So just think about what your city worships. My city, Boston, worships knowledge. Every city has its own their own one-story plotline according to the scope of what has happened in the history of that particular city. What do they value? Where do they place their hopes? So it's not whether cities are centers of worship, but what a city, we have to ask the question, what does a particular city, what is it worshiping? They're turning to false gods, such as power, fame, possessions, privilege, and comfort. So there are urban liturgies. You look at all of the buildings in your particular a city, and that will tell you exactly what it worships. A city, some of you might be familiar with Greg Beale's a book on idolatry, where he says you revere that which you resemble. You resemble that which you revere, either for ruin or for restoration. And we'd like to turn that phrase by saying a city resembles what it reveres, either for ruin or for restoration. So we're trying to say that cities are centers of worship. And so what we want to do is we want to find a point of reference rather than merely challenging it right away, but we want to engage in good communication where we are able to speak in the public space by entering into the person's storyline and then deconstructing it and then reconstructing it with the story of the gospel. Because we believe that our God is the object of worship. And this God can actually deconstruct all of the other idols that we find in our respective cities. Secondly, we're going to look at the characteristics of cities. Three things. The city as magnet. Number two, the city as an amplifier. And thirdly, the city as an engine. The city as a magnet. The city attracts all sorts of people. And there are three particular types of people that the city attracts. Number one, the marginalized person. Number two, the aspirational person. And thirdly, the explorational person. It's not coincidental when you look at the median age of every city, it's probably in the high 20s. Unless you're in some older cities where you have large pockets of older folks, like certain places in Chicago and so on. But generally, you have aspiring people. Whether they are aspiring professionals or aspiring attorneys or musicians or artists, that is where they want to go. You have somebody who grew up in a nice suburban community and she was the best violinist in her youth orchestra and she comes into the city of Boston or New York and wants to go to Juilliard or New England Conservatory and she's there with all these high expectations and aspirations and hopes and then they all get kind of deconstructed once she enters the subway and hears the person playing violin that's better than her. You've got the best of everything and the worst of everything. We have to be careful that we do not say that all of the good things are outside of city and all the bad and evil things are in cities. Well, just think about it. If you have a higher concentration of people, you're going to get more, you know, perhaps more pollution, more corruption, and more poverty. That's just because there are more people. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all the people who are living outside the city are innocent and all of the people who live in the city are somehow intrinsically more sinful. Actually, when you look at all the crazy nonsense stuff that happens, they usually happen outside the city, not inside the city. So aspirational people. Secondly, marginalized people. Some people say, oh, no, that's where all the poor are. Again, the poor are there because they're going there with aspirations and hoping that they'll be lifted from their poverty. They're just more poor people in the city, and they're going there with hopes and aspirations. Why do you think immigrants are there? Why do you think the gay community is there? Because these are the people where they go into the city hoping that they will find refuge and protection. And then again, so we need to find an entry point with the marginalized people, entry point with aspirational people, entry point with explorational people. Secondly, the city, a second characteristic, is the city is an amplifier. This is a very important a point. Urbanization turns up the volume on human innovation. About 100 years ago, you had primarily two major sectors in our economy. You had the service sector and you had manufacturing. Now, those are still very important sectors. But within the last 30 or 40 years, you have this new sector called the creative sector. And that represents about a third of our workforce. So when you think of creative, don't think of just kind of an artist who is unemployed. And we're talking about engineers are considered to be a part of the creative class. All the people in technology, they're considered to be a part of this class because entrepreneurial people, creative people, they start new things. And when you have a highly a clustered, dense community, and then on top of that, you add a connective diversity, then that's where you get amplification of intense innovation. Or to give another example, you look at our church, right? We're right in the center of Boston, and we're a racially diverse church. And it's great to have, let's give an example, two dominant cultures in our church. You've got white Americans and you've got Asian Americans. And it's great to have that mix. Why? Because you'll see Asian Americans who come and they'll defer. This is a sweeping generalization. I'm not saying everyone's like this, but Asian Americans who tend to defer better to authority. And most of them will call me Steve, will call me Pastor. And then you've got others, Western white Americans, who, again, are more autonomous, more independent. I'm not placing moral value on one over the other, but they feel comfortable calling me by my first name and so on. And so to use a counseling a setting, I'll have an Asian American fellow who's coming in, and he wants to know what he's supposed to do with his future. So he'll sit there and say, Pastor, you know, I'm considering this. What do you think I should do? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm not God. You need to take this one on faith and make a good decision. They're like, no. I want you to tell me what I'm supposed to do. So what do? I speak into his cultural idols, and I don't tell him what to do. Whereas, again, generalization, but you know, you've got a Western American who comes, and he doesn't want me to speak into his life. He wants me to be one facilitating voice among many. He'll come and tell me his story and whatever, and he'll say, hey, you know, I'd love to get your input. So what do? I tell him what he should do. You got to speak into people's idols. And so what you find in a densely populated, racially diverse situation is that the amplification for innovation, amplification for human flourishing can happen. I mean, also for human famishing as well because of idolatry. But it's great to have somebody who questions someone else from a different culture. It doesn't have to be a racial culture. It can be a generational cultural difference or even a geographic cultural difference, right? Californians are very, very strange people. They're different than Eastern people, right, Justin? And so, but it's great for him to kind of speak into my life and say, hey, why do you do it that way? You know, why do you assume that that's the best way to do it? So, I'm not assuming that. And so that person can sharpen my thinking, and we are able to to cultivate this growth together. I'm probably running out of time here, but let me just kind of finish up quickly. The third one is city as an engine, that the cities capitalize on human innovation to drive our world. That is, the fuel is creativity, the function is competition, and the fruit is a culmination. It can lead us either to flourishing or famishing. And ultimately, I want to end this by saying the city is the gospel gateway. So we need to find a point of reference and say all of these things are great, but we're not supposed to be in cities and to just worship cities as Christians and say, wow, this is great, great restaurants and great cultural center, and we ultimately end up worshiping the city. No, we're not called to worship the city. There are all sorts of idols. And there are idols in the suburbs, of course, as well. We're supposed to be in cities not to hate our cities and not to worship our cities. We're there to love and to serve our city. So we need to find a point of reference and to show them that the gospel, this God of the scriptures, this Savior Jesus, is greater than any aspiration, any hope that they would have in their storyline. And so lastly, and I'll go through this rather quickly, the Bible and the city. I did not call this the theology of a city or a city theology. Some people get kind of hung up with that term, but the Bible has a lot to say about cities. So we've broken it up into two major sections, creation, fall, and redemption. Let me see if I can go through this. Many people have assumed that when you see the garden, that it must have been some kind of a desolate barren place. Well, the Bible doesn't give us enough details to know exactly what the garden looked like, but what we do know is this, that there was cultural cultivation. We know that from the ancient Near Eastern world that most of the gardens were cultivated parks, oftentimes containing buildings, although, again, the Bible does not include that, so we can't say with great certainty. But what we do know is that the images of the garden in Genesis become urban images in the rest of Scripture. Psalm 46:4, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. Or in Revelation 21:2, the river and the tree of life, two features and items that we see in the garden, are prominently featured in the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down from heaven. And also, I would argue, in Genesis chapter 2, when the two rivers, they go out into four different rivers, whenever you have a reference in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, about four points of a compass, it's always talking about geographic expansion. In other words, it was God's intent to make the garden an expansive, cultivated area where people will be able to flourish through their obedience and through their stewardship of being a priest and so on. And Adam was a Renaissance person in that sense. You know, he was called to be all sorts of things, to be a priest, to be a vice regent, to be a horticulturalist and so on. He was asked to do many different things. However, we have the fall. So God's urban intention becomes marred by human sin. Now, some people say, oh, the word city doesn't show up until Genesis 4, and so you're really forcing this issue. So city is wrapped up with the fall and with Cain and with Babel and so on. Well, not necessarily. I think the cultural mandate is ultimately an urban mandate. And I try to show that you do have these images which are picked up later on. And so what we find in Genesis 4 and in Genesis 11 is the self-glorification project of the human heart. But it's not saying that cities are intrinsically evil. As a matter of fact, Cain's desire to want to receive self-protection in a city actually affirms what God's intention was for a city, for it to be a refuge. It's just that he was taking it into his own hands. And then, of course, during the exile, we're kicked out of the city. And then now, city and redemption, God comes down to rescue his people and dwell with them in a city again. Jesus experiences the brokenness of the city. He challenges the idols of the Jerusalem city. And he laments over Jerusalem and calls it a forsaken city. So then the question is, how can a forsaken city be called ever again to be sought out and a city not forsaken? Isaiah 62:12. And the only way that can happen is Jesus needs to die outside the gate of the city, Hebrews 13:12, that God might welcome his people back in. So he bears the judgment of God outside the city in order to allow a bunch of outsiders back into the city, into the presence of God. And then city and restoration, you see ultimately with the garden city, New Jerusalem, that descends from heaven, the Garden of Eden remade. So we will experience ultimately in the new heavens and the new earth, and you might disagree with me on this, my view of this is that I believe that there will be serious culture in heaven. There will be athletics, I believe. I believe there will be great music. I believe there will be golf. I really do. Although one of my friends said that in front of John Piper, and John was getting all upset and saying, isn't Jesus enough? You know, that's true. Jesus is enough. But I do believe that in the new heavens and new earth, you're going to get a kind of an amplified, exponential, escalated development of the old earth, minus the sin and the presence of God. You will no longer need the temple there, obviously, because the Lamb of God and God Almighty are the temple of God. You have cultural diversity and development, refuge and comfort. Of course, there'll be all sorts of racial diversity and density and human flourishing and harmonious fellowship, creativity and connective diversity, unhindered proximity to the presence of God in the context of constant worship. And what he's asking us to do is to practice the already and not yet here on earth, and to be able to plant more churches. Not everyone is called to live and to play and to plant churches and do ministry in the city, but some of you might be, and I hope you'll consider this a little more seriously. Justin.
there will also be surfing in heaven, I'm convinced. Again, I'm losing my voice, so I'll do my best to speak loud. You have to really listen up. And after I'm done speaking, we're going to do a little Q&A here at the end, so if you have some questions, Stephen and I will answer those. A lot of you are familiar with the text, Jeremiah 29:7. It gives us great vision for how to live in our cities. I'll just read that for us. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile. I sound like a smoker. I want you to know I don't smoke. Just my voice today. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its welfare, you will find your welfare. So that's vision for us of how we want to approach the city. We want to seek the welfare, the flourishing, the good of the cities where God has sent us. Think about Jesus. The gospel accounts show us two times where Jesus had tears. One account is over the death of his friend Lazarus. The other account is over a city, as Jesus looks out over a whole city full of people who he cares about. Jesus weeps over the city, longing to see the city repent and turn to God. We have a God who cares about the cities of our world. Our God loves people. Our cities are where there are vast amounts of people living who need the gospel. And we wrote this book with this overarching conviction that our God cares deeply about cities and the people in them. Two dangers that really happen when you start thinking about living and doing ministry in the city. One danger is over-contextualization, over-contextualizing. That's essentially you come into a city and you abandon your worldview. You kind of get swept up into the idols and into the storyline of that city. You end up sort of abandoning your worldview. You end up getting sort of used by the city. There's a therapist, a counselor that I know in Silicon Valley, and she says she sees two types of people in her counseling office. The first type of person is a person who came to Silicon Valley hoping to make it, hoping to strike it big with the next big startup, came there, and they didn't make it, and now they're unsatisfied. The second type of person is a person came there with the same dreams, hoping to make it, strike it big, strike it rich, be very successful. They came there, and they did make it, and now they're unsatisfied. That person, they grab so strongly onto the idols of Silicon Valley, and they got it all. They pursued that worship, they got it all, and now they realize they're empty. And so we want to understand that if we really just follow the way our cities operate without thinking through how the gospel should shape our life there and how we engage life in that city, if you just come into the city just to use the city, the irony is the city will end up using you. The irony is you'll end up realizing that these idols of the city really didn't take very good care of you, and you end up empty. Cities are not meant to carry the weight of our worship. We're people created for God to have our one great God at the center of our lives, and only he can hold the weight of our worship. If we put anything smaller than God, even a wonderful city, I'm excited. I'm going to Paris for my 10th anniversary. Can't wait. Just got those tickets booked. Can't wait. But if we put anything, even a wonderful city like Paris, if we put anything smaller than God at the center of our life, it's going to let us down. It's going to hurt us. It's going to harm us. Now, here's a second danger. That's under contextualization. That's not abandoning your worldview in the city, but it's privatizing your worldview. It's taking your Christianity, which is meant to be public. Our Christianity is not to be a private affair. Christianity is public. It's for others. And taking that, keeping it private, and you never truly really engage your city. I mean, Jesus, I'm preaching through the Gospel of John right now. In a few weeks, I'll hit John chapter 17. In John chapter 17, Jesus prayed for his disciples that they would be in the world, but not of the world. And we have to hold both of those together. Because if you overemphasize in the world, you're going to come into your city, and you really are going to start to just fall into the way your city moves and operates, and you're going to lose the gospel. And then the other emphasis is we need to be not of the world. Now, if you overemphasize not of the world, you're going to end up with just a bunch of institutions that are Christian institutions that are completely separate from your city and never really engage your city. I was kind of a product of that. I grew up in the city of Sacramento, and my whole life was Christian schools, Christian this, Christian that, Christian clothes, and not really seeing the not entering into what was really happening in our city. So we want to be people, and we want to raise up people in our churches who have this emphasis that Jesus gave us, that we're in the world, we're in our city, but we're not of our city. We're distinct there. So what we want to have is a third way. We want to contextualize our gospel in the city. We don't want to abandon it. We don't want to privatize our faith. We want to contextualize our gospel in the city. And I want us to see that this is more simple. Oftentimes you come maybe to a seminar like this, and maybe to a book like this, and you think this is this big complex thing, thinking about how to do life, how to do ministry in the city, how to do contextualization. You think, man, I'm supposed to be super smart and think through so many different things. It's really not that complex. I really think it's Jesus' command that he gave us in Matthew 19:19 to love your neighbor as yourself. I think when you think of your city, think of this as just Jesus' command writ large. What a city is a city is a place full of neighbors. Your city is a place full of all these different neighbors, all of these different people. And the story of those people's lives, their hopes, their fears, their ambitions, their worship, their drives have shaped the culture of that city over time. And so if you can think of your city as a place full of neighbors, then you can think about, well, the way I go about doing ministry in my city is the same way I go about doing ministry with my neighbor. It starts by listening first and speaking second. If you want to do effective ministry to your neighbor, to someone who lives next door to you, to someone in your workplace, to someone who you're going to school with, you get to know that person. You learn what makes them tick. You learn who they are. You learn their values. You learn their fears. And then you're able to intelligently, in a way that really connects, in a way that brings about life transformation, you can speak the gospel into their life. So think about your city in the same way. Listen first, speak second. So a great way to think about your city, some of you have probably seen the book Richard Florida wrote a couple years ago. He titled it, Who's Your City? And with that title, he personifies cities. He gives the cities a sense of personality. Think about your city that way. And I mean, that's my question for you today that I want you to think about as you're here. Who is your city? What is the personality of your city? What makes your city tick? Because every city does have a unique personality. Again, the same way you go about learning who your city is the same way you go about learning who your neighbor is, what your neighbor is like. We Stephen and I, use five questions. We think, I'm going to give these to you. We think these five questions are very helpful for understanding what makes your city tick, for understanding who your city is. Here's the first question. What is your city's history? Now, I'm not asking you to become a complete historian on your city and know all of its ins and outs, but have a general sense of the history of your city. How did it start? What foundations have been laid over the years in your city? I mean, Stephen comes from Boston, a city that's pretty old by American standards. It's important to know what makes Boston tick. It's important for me to know what makes Silicon Valley, what makes San Jose tick. I think it's significant that the history of our city has always had an entrepreneurial culture to it. So Silicon Valley today, it's very entrepreneurial. Well, it always has been. That's always been in the DNA of the city from the beginning when you go back and understand how it started. So answer that question. Spend some time thinking about that. What is your city's history? Second is, what are your city's values? Your church has core values. The company you work for has core values. They're stated. They're clear. People talk about them often. Well, your city has core values too. They're just not stated. You don't see them anywhere. Ask that question. What are the core values at the center of your city? For my city, Silicon Valley, we really think there's kind of four. As I look at my city, I see four. One is entrepreneurialism. There's no way you can really understand or connect well with people in Silicon Valley unless you understand that this is a place where a lot of entrepreneurs are. And people think that way. They do business that way. They lead that way. They're self-starters. They see a problem. They want to fix it. They want to come up with some great solution. They want to go out and impact the world. That's a deeply held value in our city. And you see it. You see it with fourth graders. And it's not just the 20-somethings, 30-somethings, 40-somethings. It starts young with how people are raised in our city. Next for our city would be work. Work is a deep, deep value in our city. No one moves to our city to rest. You know, no one goes, I'm going to go to Silicon Valley and just rest. It's a nice place to relax. Everyone moves there for work. It's a deep, deep value there. A third value is achievement. Our city is not a city of talk. People just want to achieve, get things done. And a fourth value is wealth. Now, you could argue that a lot of those values are common in other cities, but it looks different. Work is a value in Silicon Valley. It's also a value in San Diego, but it looks different. I've spent a lot of time in San Diego. People aren't driven there with work in the same way that they are where I live. So ask what your city's values are. Third question is, what are your city's dreams? What do the people dream about in your city? I mean, if you wanted to get to know your neighbor well, you want to understand what their dreams are. What are they longing for? What vision of the future do they have that's driving their life? And if you can really get that, you can then love them well and connect the gospel to their life well. Same with your city. What are your city's big dreams that drive it? I mean, Silicon Valley's big dream is more of an exporting dream. We want to be the city that impacts the rest of the world. And so we want to do things there and produce things there that go out and impact the rest of the world. That's very different than Las Vegas. What's Las Vegas's tagline? What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And so Vegas operates very differently. It's more of an importing kind of city. Let's bring consumers here. They'll come and they'll take advantage of the things we have to offer in the city. It can kind of stay here. It's this pleasure destination. Then they can go back to their life elsewhere. So doing ministry in Las Vegas is going to be very different than doing ministry in Silicon Valley. So what are your city's dreams? Fourth question is, what are your city's fears? And this is an easy question to answer if you've answered the second question. Your city's fears are just the opposite of your city's core values. So my city's great fear, first one is status quo. That's the opposite of innovation and entrepreneurialism. People in my city are so afraid of just the status quo happening. They don't want life to stay the same. They want to go and disrupt things and make the future happen. The second fear in my city is rest. Everyone in my city fears rest. Just because our city's a fast-moving city. There's so much to happen. And so one of the things I do all the time as a pastor is I talk a ton to our people about the value of rest and how one of the greatest witnesses we could have for the gospel in our city is to Sabbath, is to rest. Because if people in our city could see a community of people that rest and find their identity in Jesus, not in their work, that just blows people's minds in our city. So, you know, in Vegas, you probably don't teach much on rest, right? You probably got to tell your people, like work, like go do something. But in our city, rest really connects. Another fear in our city is failure, the opposite of the value of achievement. People fear failure. I've been to places where people fear failure, but people really, really, really fear failure in my city because they find their identity in achievement. So it's helpful to know that. And finally, limited options. Because my city wants to go out and have great wealth and have the ability to do everything, they fear having limited options and pursuing wealth as a way to feel like they can accomplish anything they want. And the fifth and final question is, what is your city's ethos? What's your city's mode of operation? How does it operate? This has really been affected by the geography, the history, the industry, the language, the climate in your city. Just take Boston versus Silicon Valley, for example. My city, Silicon Valley, is very casual. We have a very warm, kind of Mediterranean, temperate climate. It's informal. If you think about the most famous business icon from Silicon Valley, we called him Steve. We didn't call him Mr. Jobs. We called him Steve. So Stephen said at his church, most people will call him Pastor. Pastor, even his whole staff calls him Pastor. There's like no one on his staff that calls him Steve, and they call him Pastor. That's kind of the culture. I always call him Steve, just, you know, sometimes try to ruffle his feathers a little bit. I like it. And when I preached at Stephen's church, I preached there in a coat and a tie to a sophisticated Boston audience that was dressed a lot like me. That people were dressed up, were more formal, very, very polite in their conversation. I would never preach looking like that where I'm from because my city's different. I preach looking like this. It's very casual. Nobody calls me pastor. It'd be kind of nice if someone called me pastor. You get a little respect. No one calls me that. No, you got to earn it. Yeah. You got to dress like it. Yeah. So understand the ethos of your city. Like my city, Silicon Valley, is built around the car. So we are, San Francisco, which is 50 minutes north of me, is the second most dense city in America. We talked about that in our trivia earlier. But our city is a lot larger in terms of population. We have way more people than San Francisco, but we're way more spread out. San Francisco is a city. It's 7 miles by 7 miles, very walkable. People get around through walking and public transportation. My city is built around the car. So that affects how you do church planting, how you do relationships, how you do community. So I want to encourage you, use those five questions. There's many more questions you can ask, but if you use just those five, it'll really help you. And I encourage you, do this with community. Don't do this just by yourself. Do this in community. Get a group of people and think through these questions together. Don't make it too hard. Talk through these questions. Read your newspaper. Walk your city. Go to your city's events and learn what makes it tech, makes it tick. The last thing Stephen and I would want is for you to walk out of here feeling intimidated by any of this. I want you to go back to your city and be a better missionary to your city than you've ever been before and feel like this isn't going to be that difficult. I'm going to just thoughtfully think through scripture in my city. I'm going to think through that this is a place full of neighbors. I want to get to know them and seek how to love them. Next thing I want to talk about is the story of your city. We believe that every city has its own storyline. Every city has its own story. We talked earlier about every city has its unique history. A helpful way to think is that is to think about one word. Stephen kind of touched on this earlier. One word that summarizes what the story of your city is all about. We're going to talk about three steps for knowing your city's story. We're talking about knowing your city's story, challenging your city's storyline, and retelling your city's storyline with the gospel. And the first step is to know your city's story. And most of us aren't in touch with this in the same way that a fish isn't in touch with the fact that it's in water. We're not in touch with this because we've been so immersed in it. It's only when that water's taken away that we're aware of our context. It's only when we're kind of just our story of our city's disrupted that we really get in touch with it. Silicon Valley, if I was to reduce it to one word for understanding our city's storyline, and again, we're very aware that every city's complex and unique. I don't want to give you this one word and think that adequately sums up how everyone lives in your city. Every city is full of, you know, hundreds of little mini cultures and mini communities that are distinct and are unique, but we do think this is a very helpful practice for beginning to get a handle on your city. So the one word for Silicon Valley would be success. That is the story that everyone is following in our city. Stephen spoke about it in Boston. The one word for Boston would be knowledge. I mean, more colleges in Boston than anywhere else. Knowledge really drives that city. San Francisco, equality would probably be a good word for understanding how that city operates. Think about your city. What would be that one word that helps you really understand the storyline of your city? Now, we're not just inventing this or making this up. I think the Apostle Paul's ministry represented this well. If you went home tonight, studied through the book of Acts, and watched how the Apostle Paul came into cities, how he presented the gospel, he did it differently in different cities. I think what made his ministry so effective is he really knew his context. He knew the storyline of his city, the idols that are bad and negative in that city, and then the values that are actually very good that he could use and leverage, and then he presented the gospel to those. So if you think about Paul, here's some words we'd suggest. The city of Jerusalem, a great word for that city story would be tradition. When Paul came into Jerusalem and presented the gospel, he was dealing with this great, huge tradition there and disrupting it with the gospel. The city of Rome, power. He was speaking to power in that city. Ephesus, religion or spirituality is there in the city. Athens, similar to Boston, knowledge. Come into Athens and spoke into the knowledge of that city. So the first thing is to know your city's story. Think about it. What is your city's story? What is that? I challenge you to think about that even before you go home. What is maybe one word that best summarizes the story people live by in your city? Now, the second piece is to challenge your city's story. Again, think about this in the same way you would speak to your neighbor. Getting to know your neighbor, you want to know their story, what makes them tick, and then you want to come in and challenge the parts of their story, disrupt the parts of their story that are faulty foundations that are going to end up crushing them. So you want to skillfully confront the idols at the foundation of your city's story. Think about what Paul did in the city of Thessalonica, a great city, leading city of the district of Macedonia, a very big city for that time, 100,000 people. He says this in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9. He says, "For they themselves report concerning us the kind of reception we had among you, how you turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God." I think the greatest problem, in my opinion, in the church today is that people come into our churches and they add a little bit of Jesus onto the top of their lives, and their existing idolatry stays firmly intact. Whatever they've put at the center of their life, success, wealth, whatever it is, and Jesus just kind of gets sprinkled on top. He's a nice little cherry on top. But their fundamental core of who they are and what they worship has not changed. And so what we want to do in our cities, what we want to do in our churches, is identify and really disturb those idols at the center of someone's life, show them that their idol that they love does not love them back, that idol is not going to love them, will not care for them, will not be for them when they fail, but there is a greater person who they can worship and give their life to who will always love them. It's based on grace. It's based on undeserved love. And then they can begin to pursue life in their city in a different way. So part of your city's story is also built on very, very good things. For example, my church has three core values. Our third core value is the value of vocation, work. We want to leverage what's already a very strong value in our city. Everyone moves to our city for work. And we think that's a deeply biblical value, to work well, to know your strengths, your gifts, your calling, to know how you can, as Stephen said, pursue the cultural mandate God has given us and use your strengths and talents so that your city and so that others would flourish. That value is already strong in our city. So we want to leverage that. But at the same time, we want to challenge it, because in our city, that value becomes central and people worship it. So you want to see what's not healthy, what's idolatry, and challenge it, but also what's glorious and what's good and what's part of common grace, and leverage those things in your city. And that's the third step, is to retell your city's story. Silicon Valley is all about success. Now, if I came into my city and I just stood in front of people and said, Jesus died for your sins, well, that's part of the gospel and at the very core of our gospel, substitutionary atonement. But if that's not connected to how anyone in my city thinks or operates, that's not going to be a very effective presentation of the gospel. It's not what was modeled by Jesus, by the Apostle Paul, by any of the writers of the New Testament. If instead I can speak into these deep longings in my city for success and show them that they don't have to work so hard to try to prove themselves, that there is a God who's done everything for them, and they can have an identity based on grace, which then sets them free to pursue success in a whole new way. Their identity doesn't rise and fall on their performance. That then starts to connect with my city in a whole different way. So you want to retell your city's story with the gospel. Show how the gospel actually enables them to pursue success or knowledge or equality, whatever your city's thing is, in a whole different way. I'm going to bring this to conclusion in just a minute so we get time for Q&A. I want to conclude just by saying this is an amazing opportunity. Some stats we have, and we present this in the book, that in the year 100 AD, so just about 70 years after the ascension of Jesus, there was as few as 25,000 Christians. This is based on research done by Rodney Stark. As few as 25,000 Christians in the world. But in the year 310, so just about 200 years later, there were over 20 million Christians in the world. That's massive growth. How did that happen? Well, that really happened through cities. That happened as the gospel went out to the major cities of the world, starting in the Mediterranean world. Massive amounts of people were converted to faith in Christ. And as the gospel reached those cities, the gospel went out and reached the surrounding regions. And so this is an opportunity for us to get a God-sized vision for what God could do in our cities. What he did in the ancient world 2,000 years ago, we think what he's doing right now is on the same kind of a scale, where more people now are living in cities than any other time in human history. We think the impact could be even greater right now if the great cities of our world could be reached with the gospel of Jesus and the planting of churches. So I'm going to invite Stephen up, and we're going to do some Q&A. Oh, yeah.
Really quick enough,
is there a Dwayne Klein in this room? No. Okay, Stephen's coming up. If you have a question, just raise your hand, just speak loud.
When you look at every world-class city, I can say it this way, that the city of Boston looks more like the city of Hong Kong than it does with a town called South Hamilton, 30 miles north of Boston. So in other words, the characteristics of world-class cities, more established cities, not emerging cities necessarily, the characteristics are very, very similar. So all of the features that I've outlined, now minus maybe less racial diversity for some of these places, but there is innovation, technology, there are centers of worship and centers of power and culture and so on.
Well, I'll give one just short one. For example, we don't meet on Sunday mornings, in part because of our answer to these questions. Our city, every city is, but our city is very, very busy. We feel like a gift we could give our people is another weekend morning. So if Silicon Valley people could have Sunday morning to relax, sleep in, we feel like we're more likely to get them to church in the afternoon. We meet in the afternoon, 4 p.m. For our service. And that's not just, hey, we just want to do this and be cool. We think that's a helpful way to reach this city. We think people are going to be more likely to engage with the church if they feel like, hey, I can kind of relax on a Sunday morning. Our city just isn't used to church. Church isn't really a part of life out there. So they don't have in their mind Sunday morning, like your question assumed, we meet in church on Sunday morning. No one in our city really thinks like that. I mean, obviously some people do, but the vast majority of our city doesn't think, oh, church is Sunday morning. They think, church, yeah, when do people at churches meet?
Yeah, that's why I think that city churches need to focus on many different ministry fronts. So you might have had some traditional churches that would have emphasized primarily evangelistic worship, and absolutely necessary, because there are many progressive churches, neo-evangelicals, that are kind of going the other way. So That's absolutely essential. And then you'll have some mainline churches that'll emphasize on social justice and mercy and so on. But if you can find a church that focuses on four ministry fronts, on evangelistic worship on the one hand, you've got community development on another front, then you've got the integration of faith and work and social justice and mercy. Now you've got a church that can't be categorized as being conservative or liberal, but you actually have a church that is believing the gospel and having that gospel shape everything that you do. So we look at all the number of hours that our people volunteer in our city, because that's a great amount of credibility, and also letting people know that we want to encourage people to do justice. But that doesn't mean that they're doing it at the expense of getting rid of the declaration of the gospel. No, I mean, that is a centerpiece of what we do at our church. And then we also have a robust philosophy of cultural engagement that recognizes the integration between faith and work, and we give them a theology of work because we want people to realize that God has called them to be representatives in their particular industry and to have a faithful presence there pursuing the common good and perhaps looking for opportunities to be able to be more missional by sharing the gospel.
Yeah, I'll start by saying we don't advocate one model. Many different types of churches are needed to reach a city. I mean, I think one helpful way of thinking about churches in the city is the same way you think about hotels. This city of Orlando doesn't need, 20 places. Just like, what's this place called? Shingle Creek, whatever. Yeah, it needs like one of these places. And then it needs a variety of different hotels to serve the different clientele in the city. I think that's a helpful way to think about churches. Many different churches are needed because cities are so diverse, have so many people. Many different types of churches and types of ministry models are needed. Now, we're arguing for certain theological convictions that need to be a part of that, a certain theological vision for impact in the city. Everything Stephen just said about evangelistic worship, community, social justice, those ingredients need to be there. But in terms of conversation about multi-site, mega church, small church, my answer would be yes, like all of those models are needed to reach our cities.
I'll just add one thing. Everyone contextualizes. The question is it good contextualization or bad contextualization? Some people think, oh, I don't contextualize. That in and of itself is your contextualization. And so we have to be engaged in fruitful contextualization that recognizes and finding a point of reference and introducing them to the gospel, as opposed to saying, well, we're going to be locked into a certain way of doing things from the 18th century because we just think that's more biblical. Well, you might not be reaching your community because people are not interested in that. So, well, it will depend on what kind of city it is. For example, if you go to St. Louis, St. Louis doesn't have in their center city, part of the center city of the church, many residential homes. And, St. Louis is really, you can have a St. Louis address and be like 20 miles apart, right? It's a modern city, and it's not built on a European model like New York or Boston. And so, it'll be different. That'll be kind of more like a neighborhood a church. But are you interacting with some of the cultural engines in the city? Well, absolutely. I mean, you can be in Tower Grove, for example, right? Our friend Darren Patrick, that's a different kind of a city church. But, he has campuses at Tower Grove, and then he has another one at another place. But they're all very different neighborhoods. Whereas in Boston, it's a small city. It's a walkable city, but it's very densely populated. And you don't need a church in Back Bay and then another one in the South End. I mean, eventually we need more churches, but so you need to be strategic. So one of our campuses is actually 8 miles away, trying to reach another a group of people, but that's right outside at the edge of the city. So I would say, first of all, having a city vision is a personal core value of mine. So if a larger suburban church were to ask me to come, I probably wouldn't consider it. And I have actually had an opportunity, so I'm not just saying this. And then it would depend where it is. I mean, if God's calling me to go anywhere, and again, if he's calling me to go to the suburban church, he'd have to really show me that's where he wants me to be. But I have to go wherever God calls me to go, and I have to be obedient to that. But I think that if you're going to a new city, do exactly what we said over here. You need to exegete your community. You need to know what the idols are, what the storyline is, and then to start praying for it. Prayer is very important. You got to pray for your city. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.